very welcome along to episode 2 of the Greg Hughes podcast. Our guest today is a man who spent the last 40 years at the heart of the community in Letterkenny, known to many simply as Jerry the Barber. He's occupied a unique vantage point, listening to the concerns, stories and frustrations of people from all walks of life across County Donegal. However, our guest has recently moved from behind the barber chair to the political stage, following his run as an independent candidate in the 2024 general election. Now he's authored a new book entitled Saving Democracy, A Proactive Plan. Pleased to welcome onto the show our guest, Jerry McKeever.
Thanks very much, Greg. Thanks for having me.
It's an interesting story, yours, isn't it? Take us back to your early life in Letterkenny, I presume?
Letterkenny, born in Derry, bred in the Market Square, so very, very local. The two buildings that were knocked down, actually, I lived in one of those on the Market Square. And barbed in town for 40 years, so it's a very concise, very uneventful history.
What was the early years like in and around Letterkenny?
So much has changed. It was a very, I was thinking about 1974, there were about 4,000 people living in Letterkenny. Massive number of people that worked in the hospital, etc., things like that, post office. Nice town. You know, your old town gang was different to your Glencairn gang and a lot of football teams. And yeah, I like Letterkenny back then. It's a good town.
Do you think change was inevitable? I mean, obviously, it's the county's main town, right? And it's huge. The population was always going to grow. People often hark back to the old days, you know, and I think every big town stroke small city has that story. Change was inevitable, do you think, was it?
Of course it was. We moved on so much. A lot more wealth came into the society, etc., and a lot more aspiration came into the society, which has really probably fed into where we are today. Maybe too much aspiration, I don't know. Some would say that the council allowed an awful lot of things into town. Whenever businesses wanted to get in, was always given permission. Good thing, bad thing, I don't know. People say the town's very busy, it's congested, but you know, that's also saying the town's very busy. So, good thing, though, the town has grown a lot, and it benefits from being the town which feeds the west coast of Ireland. We're very lucky with the west coast of Donegal. We're very lucky. We have that that hub that those people come towards, you know. So it's a lucky town, Hank. It's a good town.
Yeah, and the development of the town, I mean, obviously, look, there's flaws in it, right? But the basis of it is it's built on the side of a hill, really effectively, isn't it? So an orderly development of it was always going to be complicated if you kept and wanted to keep the traditional main street.
Yeah, I suppose, like, well, could you put the big businesses that were down in what they call Little Britain on the main street? I don't know. You probably couldn't, you know, so you did have to develop outwards. And no, it was inevitable, probably. And I suppose every main street in the country is suffering to a certain extent. We've seen an opening today, actually. LJ's cafe opposite me on the main street. Good to see it open. Look, the town is probably doing as well as any town in the country. At the same time, it has its problems, but I suppose what town hasn't?
The role of a barber, it's like a hairdresser or a nail technician. It is, and I think particularly for lads, is it one of the few places we open up or, you know, get stuff off our chests?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversations in there. Like, personally, I think I'm one of these people that kind of wears their hearts in their sleeves, and I'm quite open. I'm a bit of an open book, and I'm not saying I blurt out everything about myself, but I think that openness leads to other people talking. I have a lot of good comrades. I have a lot of people that I regard now as friends and maybe acquaintances and friends in the barbershop who, you know, when you come in, you're going to have a conversation with you, and it is good, you know, and occasionally you have the odd guy in who's come back and said, you know, thanks for that wee chat we had, because, you know, it makes a wee difference. And, you know, where do you find that anymore? We become very detached, very solitary in our habits nowadays. Maybe social media has done that, just I don't know. We need a few more outlets for conversation, just for conviviality in general, Greg.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's put down to different people coming into an area and people get more sort of siloed or... But I think regardless of where you are, we're not as friendly as we used to be. We're not as inclined to you know, say our neighbours getting on it, seen as sticking your nose in. I don't know. There seems to be, and I've observed this before. If you go to, you know, New York or London or Birmingham or Dubai, the old school Irish community of looking out for each other is still there. And yet here at home, it seems we've lost it to some extent. I'm not sure ever to get it back.
I think half what's going on here is maybe it's a consideration too. You wonder, do your neighbours want to see you? You know, so it's not just that we ourselves don't want to visit. It's that we feel, should we visit? Because we've all become so insular. And it's very, very unfortunate because, you know, we're maybe as well as that because we're more urbanised. I think as rural communities years ago, we're much more prone to this sociability. I mean, you know, up Iona years ago when I was growing up, houses were open, people walked into each other's houses at a chat, you know, can't do that anymore. It just isn't going to be on anymore. We've just become insular, private, quiet. And I do think maybe social media is a small factor there too. We've just become more insular.
I wonder, is it less safe now? I mean, obviously, listen, there's more people, more crime. But, you know, I remember when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, it felt very much like the same country, but we were allowed to do whatever we wanted to do. We'd go out sort of to play in the mornings in the summer, and Mom would throw a white sheet out on the balcony when it was time to go home in the evening for dinner. She wouldn't see us 12, 13, 14 hours. And I know myself now as a parent, you know, even the boys in their 20s, like I'm still a helicopter dad. You know, I haven't afforded them the freedom that I enjoyed. I wonder how much of it's self-imposed. You get where I'm coming from?
Yeah, is it a sort of coming from the top that we've society now that's very, very regulated, there's rules. I mean, you look, for instance, at how difficult it is for voluntary associations to get volunteers to go and look after places to I mean, now you think you need maybe one adult per 8 children, 10 children, say in a youth club, whatever, things like that. So everyone's regulated to a certain extent. And I think maybe we feel we've got to regulate as well. To seem responsible. My parents need to regulate to seem responsible as well. And I think it's very unfortunate because, again, we've just lost that sociability. And it all comes back to that because we've become very urbanised. I think, again, maybe communities in the country maybe don't act this way. It's unfortunate. Can we get it back? I don't know. You know, I'm sort of on the wavelength of my book here very often. I think, you know, I would love to go back to a more urban attitude. I think in Germany they've decided that the urbanisation, centralisation of the cities is not a good idea. They're trying to get back to the rural. And, you know, our government are very, very, very much Dublin-centric. Mm. They're going to spend a lot of money on a metro line, things like that. You know, they're going to possibly take water from the Shannon to Dublin, all Dublin-centric. I think we should be looking after rural areas more. For instance, Donegal, we get probably half the infrastructure spend we should be get. So we're not really nurtured as a society anymore. From the top to the bottom, we're not nurtured that way.
But it's like in every country, though, the further you are from the seats of power, the more disadvantaged you are. Isn't that always the case? I mean, it doesn't mean we should accept it, but it's always the case, isn't it?
It is going to be the case, yeah. And I suppose, as Spock said on the Wrath of Khan, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. So, you know, you do have to look after the studies. But I just think, I mean, you look at the figures, I mean, the North West District, the three counties in Ulster and the five in Connacht, is 70% of Ireland's population, 10% of the spend. You know, we are neglected. And again, I mean, is it possible, like, I mean, to get the idea going that I've got in the book that we can find people that just see governments more holistic as opposed to just corporate and taxation, etc. And if we could get a government that thinks more holistically, maybe we could think more about mental health and about the sociability, this, you know, this over-regulation in society, in associations, as in business, all the red tape, you know. I think the only way we can get back to it again is to find a different group of people to govern us.
Okay, and I'm going to dig into the book in much more detail a little later on. What about us, though? Do we do enough for ourselves? Like, I mean, there are other countries like counties, for example, like Kerry, right? Who seem to be very positive, very driven. They don't really have any manufacturing. They don't have any big bases down there, but they get on with it, right? And tourism is a big thing and they embrace it, you know. Are we too negative up here at times? And I'm not, I don't believe this, but I just want to have the conversation with you, right? So we talk about tourism, we talk about, well, let's get more motorhome parks. So we try and develop them. Next thing, the objections come in. You know, we're not having that in area. Why? Well, I don't want it there, but also the infrastructure isn't there. You know, whereas I'm not sure, do we have those same conversations in the likes of a Kerry?
Yeah, we there's going to be a degree of negativity, and it's all right, you know. But I mean, maybe it's because we feel neglected, and we are the forgotten county. Maybe, you know, justifiably, we feel a bit negative about things, and we don't have the infrastructure we need. And I mean, I've heard about four stories last year of people who can't build their own land and stuff like that. And there's plenty of reasons to complain up here. Maybe we should try to be more positive, but it's not always easy.
That's what I think. I just wanted to tease out the possibility it could be our fault. So you've spent 40 years as Jerry the Barber in Letterkenny. At what point, or if there is a particular point in those four decades of listening to your customers and just chatting out in the street and wherever you might be, did you realise you were hearing, or what you were hearing, were symptoms of a dysfunctional political system, for an example, and not just the everyday woes?
Well, you know, it's funny. I wrote a book 5 years ago called Binocracy, Democracy's Last Chance, the idea that this idea I call it binocracy, but what I like to call benevolent democracy. And the idea actually came to me back in, I think it was 2008 or 2009. I was standing outside the barbershop one night, about Friday, about 6:45. It was open at 7 o'clock then. It was dark, it was cold. And Jim McCormick, who owned McGee's, of course, came down the street. Very heavily involved in Tidy Towns, of course. And he was in his usual suit, his uniform suit at work. Always looked very, very well. And he was picking up rubbish in the street on a dark, dull evening. And I just thought, you know, to myself, you know, that's the sort of person there that we need. A person who has a social conscience, a person who wants to give to community, a person who has a vocation to help out, but at the same time has run a really good business, knows what he's doing, you know. So the seed was planted there. And then you're talking to people, especially during the recession, just about, you know, would it be great that we had people like that in government? Because we do often say we should have more business people in politics. And then it was really, I mean, Greg, I think I find myself, when I'm off, I'm quite lazy. When I'm off, I'm prone to be off. And it was during COVID in 2020, the COVID break, and a friend of mine, Pat, rang me and just seeing how we're getting on, etc. And I'd thought about writing this book, and I committed because I said to Pat, I'm going to write this book, I think. So having said it, I didn't. I spent that first lockdown writing a book. And I just think, I see something in this idea. And I sometimes I feel like a madman crying in the wilderness. Is there something in my idea or isn't there? I don't know. But I feel a very strong vocation to push it, because if it is an answer, I feel that it's my duty to push it, because, you know, I believe that if things are ever to get better, we'll start with an idea. I think we're bereft of ideas. I think I have a duty to push it, because we're living in a time when a lot of us complain, a lot of us chronicle, a lot of us analyze what's going on. A lot of people make videos about the dysfunctionality in the country. These people are very important. It's important they do this. But if that's all we're going to do, Greg, I feel that that's inertia. I feel real activism will come from actually having an idea that we want to get behind, having a plan, and then forming a group from that plan to actually take us somewhere, to actually do something very, very proactive. Otherwise, I think we're lost. We're going through a period of inertia where all we do is complain. So I feel that obligation to...
But how do you engage people, though? Because even in the last general election, we saw the Greens, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, do reasonably well. Sinn Féin looked like they may make some inroads, okay? But as it turns out, they stumbled on this promise of change, and people started going, this sounds very much like Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and they end up really effectively 20-20-20, right? There was no massive independent movement as such. There are independents that are very powerful, right? But they're very big party adjacent at the same time. Surely, if there was ever going to be a change, would the last election not have given us some indication that that change could happen?
Change was the big word at the last election, if you remember. And it didn't seem to happen. And people have said to me, you know, Jerry, things have to get worse again before people move for change. Wait, I think I would say there's a number of vital ingredients we need for change. Number one, we need jeopardy, unfortunately. We need to be in trouble. And then I think, you know, where I come in again, hopefully, if my idea is a runner, we need an idea and we need a plan and we need a manifesto. And, you know, I feel that, you know, the manifestos that our parties present at the moment, they're not radical enough. Tweaks, changes, it's like rearranging deck chairs in Titanic. I think we need a radical manifesto. Like we spoke during my election campaign last year, and my cornerstone was more that national is local. I believe that if you're going to fix law and order in Letterkenny, you've got to fix the Garda Síochána. If you want to fix the Letterkenny Hospital, you've got to fix the HSE. If you want to fix really what our problem is, we don't have homes, you've got to fix infrastructure. Infrastructure is my big thing. So we've got a manifesto, I think, built around a promise to improve our infrastructure and to do things like that. And I think that's the core, that's the root.
Like, I don't want to misphrase it, so you contradict me as soon as possible. But I remember you saying that, and I find it interesting. But you were looking to capture voters in a moment, okay? And really, I felt, or I'm feeling speaking to you now, you really need them to get on board with what you're saying, right? Because it's a completely different approach. It's not parish pump politics. It's almost, you know, from the top down. So in other words, you have to work on the top and have patience for eventually that to trickle down. We thinking really short cycles in this country, though. How would you ever get people to come along with you in that way?
Well, I think the message, like I always come up with this idea that, you know, I would say this happens all over the country. This happens in other counties too. But imagine a guy looking at his store's window at the road in front of his house. He's beautifully tired. The potholes are fixed. The councillor, TD, whatever, got his potholes fixed. And he thinks, God, I'm voting for him again. He fixed my potholes. That's great, you know. Not realizing that because of the way these people run the country, his daughter's in Australia. He has to watch his grandkids grow up in Skype, you know. And this guy thinks he's a winner. I think we have to, you know, and I would love to think if this thing gets going, we'll have people maybe thinking on this wavelength. And if we get that message across often enough, it might actually hit, you know, because, you know, we have so many people growing up in Australia that I know a lot of people want to go away, but I spoke to a class of five students in the politics class down in Carindona last year, and I asked them all a question you'd asked actually a few days earlier in Milford School: how many of you are going away after your education is done? All five are going away. I asked, how many of you want to come back? All five want to come back if there's a country worth coming back to. So I think, you know, that message, and I mean, I'm actually bringing out a few books tomorrow to the university. I spoke to Joseph Sweeney, the president of the student union, and he told me that he would take 8-10 books off me, and the students, he'd get a heap of students to read and probably give feedback, etc. Because we've got to get to the young here.
Is that where the movement comes from then, really? Are the rest of us too old in the hat, too long in the game?
Well, possibly. I find that Greg, an idea is very hard to sell. I think we've become so custom, so acclimatized, so programmed that what we do is this complaining thing, and we watch Prime Time, etc., and we think we're keeping abreast. But I think we need to focus on the idea. Socrates said that the secret of change is not to focus not on the old, but on building the new. I sometimes say to people, I can imagine a line directly out in front of me, on the left-hand side of this line, we have all the dysfunctionality. We have the all the departments are so badly run. We have all that's gone wrong in the country in the last 10, 15 years. But this side, then, I see the potential future. And I don't see the harm in people, just for even an hour and a half, look at the book or listen to a few videos they're making, to look at an idea. Because let's say you're going to spend an hour, 2 hours every day for the next year talking about what we're going through and talking about dysfunctionality. I'm not having the same conversation every day. Why not for an hour and a half or 2 hours have a look at a new idea that might just work if enough people get behind it? So that's where I'm coming from.
Okay, and I want to go into that a bit more, but we live in a society now, right, whereby there are an awful lot of people doing well. A lot of people are doing well. You know, we have the haves and the have-nots, and a lot of people are doing well. They're keeping the current governments in situ and so on and so forth, right? And then we have a massive, massive gap down to 350,000 people in arrears on gas and electricity. Hundreds of thousands of children living in actual poverty, not pretending poverty, real poverty, right? So do we need to fix that first? Or could you move forward with the plan, which we'll dig into in a bit, you know, on the basis, because it's like, that's all mine. You can't have any of that. That's all mine. And I'm okay. So that'll be okay.
Well, what it comes down to, of course, whether you like it or not, Greg, is affordability. What sort of money are we bringing in? What can we afford to do? But I honestly believe, I have a very, very idealistic picture of what I have in my book now. And ideally, and we can get to that, how I think this can happen in a while, I could see two candidates standing in every constituency at the next election, maybe 12 months' time if you can force an election, if things go badly enough in the next year, getting 70 people elected and being in charge, not having to compromise too much with our parties. And
so, in other words, get enough elected to be the equivalent of the rural independents that are propping up the government at the moment and start exercising power that way?
I'm hoping to get 70 people elected.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I'm hoping to I know it's idealistic, but I'll get that in a wee while. And look, maybe some people might turn off now and think I'm crazy. But look, I think theoretically, the book makes sense. Practically, who knows? I think enough to get behind it can work. But the point I was making was, you know, if we get those good people elected, who I regard as good people, hopefully people of integrity, then they can look in the budget and see where do we spend the money first. And they do say, you know, that you judge a society by the way it treats its elderly, and it's impoverished. And we need more empathy going in that direction. We have to have it. But I think really, you know, the secret of fixing our cost of living crisis for everyone is that we must make accommodation more affordable. If accommodation come in, if we do the massive infrastructure project, if we can then relax planning permission because we can build in more land, if land's cheaper because there's more land for sale, if you're allowed to build your modulars that they can build in the continent, if you can have a house up for 180 grand, then you can afford your mortgage. Then you've got maybe 600 quid a month extra in your pocket tax-free that you're not paying out in rent, but you're paying the mortgage at 60% of the price. Then you can go out and use the shops. Then you can go out and keep money circulating in the economy. That is how you fix the crisis in the cost of living, not by putting the minimum wage up. All wages go up. The landlord sees you get more money, puts in 100 quid in the rent. Prices go up. Then the wage goes up again in 18 months' time. We're in a death spiral here, Greg, I think, with us.
It's interesting. The only problem is, and maybe this is just an ideology and it's not unique to Ireland, that's not really how governments want things to work, because if they try and suppress spending to keep inflation down, so as soon as there's any money floating about, the price of everything goes up. You know, this is why we have this economic cycle. Is it? I don't know. It feels incredibly unfair, but decisions are made to cool the economy, and that really generally means people being less well off with the money that they're making. I'm not an economist, but that'd be my sort of observation.
Well, again, I'm not an economist, and there's an awful lot of stuff I don't know, but again, I'm not intending to, I don't even want to run this thing. I'd be a perfect scenario for me if people got the idea in the book and then went ahead and ran with it.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because the rest is me just whataboutery, really. So the framework then of what do you describe it, a political movement, a political party, a...
Well, can I describe first? I mean, I have a chapter here in Ireland, and I do give my opinion on certain things that happened in Ireland in the last whatever number of years, you know, and how we can fix it. And I think basically what we need is two things to actually achieve what I would love to see achieved. The first thing we need is we need the new party. We need the new party. We need these people. And let's jump to the manifesto first that this party might adopt. And I have maybe 12 items on a potential manifesto here. I believe that we need a political party that's going to protect our right to freedom of speech. We need a political party that's going to stand up for Ireland's sovereignty. I do believe we need a massive stimulus package. We have 30 billion sitting there in reserve. We need to spend that to future-proof ourselves. If we can, say, add another 15, 20 billion to that, spend it on our electricity grid, our water supply, if they can fix, for instance, if they fix the leaks on the Dublin study, They get 37% of water leaks away. That's indicative of what happens all over the country. We fix our sewage system. With those three vital components, we can then go on and build houses to beat the ban. We can build what we can afford, and we can tackle the cost of living problem that way. We need to overhaul our immigration policies. We need to overhaul our Gardaí Shehana. And I think we spend about 2.5 billion a year on a rank and file Gardaí. This has got to be 5 billion. This has got to be, we've got to recruit 50% extra Gardaí. We've got to up the wage for people who are recruited.
What for? What do we need more guards for?
Well, you know, I think law and order is falling away. You know, we need more guards. We need probably more prison service, etc. We need more security in general. We not only need security there, we need cyber security. Mm. You know, there's all sorts of things we need to do. Need guards recruited to do cyber security. Everything, we need to cover security from all angles. We need to bring back our urban councils. We need to get our voice back ourselves again.
Can I go back to immigration? What is the immigration plan? Because, you know, if anyone was interested in what you're saying, Jerry, and maybe this is the problem, there's a couple of things they're going to dig into, okay? And you mentioned immigration, and instantly they're going to go, well, what, do we pull up the drawbridge? What are you proposing? Now, obviously, you know, that would have to happen through consensus and what have you in any party setup. But what do you believe we need to do in terms of immigration?
Well, I call this a hot potato before when I was speaking to you, and you said it's not really a hot potato, so we have to talk about it. And we do have to talk about it. We absolutely do. Well, I would again like to think, you know, that if we have what I regard as empathetic good people in government, they will come up with a fair immigration policy. We cherry pick from other countries, see how they're handling their dirt. I think we should cherry pick for all sorts of things, accommodation, etc., immigration. Look how other countries are handling it, and find a very responsible, reasonable attitude to immigration. I mean, you know, I'm not a racist. You guys can call me moderate before, and I am moderate. But you know, there's things going on. Like, I mean, there is a situation in the moment where I think there's blatant discrimination going on and racism, and that certain people now get massive grants to open businesses that others that maybe indigenous areas don't get. I think that's discrimination, you know, and I think what happens there is, for instance, that we're going to find that indigenous areas, people who own business, will end up closing down. And I just don't think that's fair. I'm looking for fair play from all quarters, from both angles. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an awful lot we have to look at here. And again, I want clever people to meet look at this.
No, I think fair. I mean, anyone I speak to, and I'm not saying exactly what you're saying is true, and I'm not saying it's not true either. But it is fairness, you know, in terms of the rental situation. Okay, no one has a particular issue with, say, Ukrainian people getting €600 towards rent, but mm-hmm. it should be for everyone because then that's fair.
Yes,
right. And it's policies like that that drive yes. division. It's not that yes. people by default dislike other people. But when we were talking a little earlier on about the way Ireland was and the way Ireland is, like, I'm not sure if it's by accident or design, but governments are very good at turning the people on each other. And that's why I think it's difficult to get a political movement off the ground, because it's infighting amongst people. We don't decide what we have in common and what our common issues are and move forward. Mm-hmm. We start criticising each other. I mean, some of these YouTube channels that are constantly having a go at people of different nationalities and what have you, they're quite literally doing the government's work, because people, it's not podcasts about the government and corruption and how money's spent and poverty and the abuse of women and domestic violence. Mm. It's about that person's going to build a church that they like in that corner, and that's a big problem. If I were in power, I'd be sitting at home watching EastEnders going, it's a handy evening. I'm not getting any abuse here. They're all fighting amongst each other.
Hmm. I've made that point a few times in the last week, that, you know, that we must actually stop debating ourselves by falling out about certain things. I mean, for instance, you know, let's say we disagree in one or two topics. Some people say, you know, I'm not sitting at the table with that man. I won't join that group. You know, if we generally all want, you know, freedom of speech, sovereignty in the country, peace and quiet in our country, law and order, then we really want the same things. We should be getting together. And, you know, and some, a couple of people I thought of there actually yesterday was Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley. Two people were so divergent in their attitudes, but yet they got together and achieved this, you know. So we have to find what unites us. And there's an awful lot you need. So we have to stop separating ourselves. And I think we have to stop the echo chamber run. You know, it's we need to calm down, think about things. And that's what I want to get people together here who are critical thinkers and can think these things through and try and take us to a better place.
I think one of the struggles people have in creating a new party, and we've seen this in Britain more recently than maybe we've seen in Ireland. Firstly, AINTA would be an interesting example in this country in that it's a pretty good party with pretty good foundations, but struggling to grow. But when you get breakaway parties in Britain, for an example, and you start trying to gather like-minded people in, very quickly you realize that something new, the infighting starts very, very quickly. And next thing you know, you're trying to gather in loads of different people with the one common, perhaps, sense that what's happened before is wrong. But then the infighting starts on the immigration, the transgender debate, the housing debate, the whatever it might be, you know. Is that a challenge, do you think, could be overcome with a new movement?
Well, I think, you know, the way I would try to think to go about doing that is to, if you do have your core of people, like I intend at some stage possibly to have some sort of book launch, but not just a book launch, an official book launch, and that we'll also be hopefully gathering people who may be have an interest in this and we want to stay around afterwards and talk about it. And if you have a group and let's say they agree wholeheartedly or almost with the manifesto I've laid out there, well, I mean, if that's your starting ground, and people think, God, that makes a lot of sense, then you will attract people that are thinking that way as opposed to people who are going to follow it with this thing or another. And I also want to make the point that if you do disagree with someone or something, let's still talk about it. Mm. You know, we've lost our ability. Like, there actually have a chapter in the book about critical thinking. And one of the methods I want to see us get around critical thinking is I think kids in secondary school, and some schools do this, is they should have debate class. Mm. They should all partake in debate class. We should all learn how to discuss things, how to disagree, how to see the other side of an argument. You know, I think in a debate class, kids should not be told which side of the debate they're arguing until the debate starts. That way you've got to think about both. You talk with your friends, you discuss the topic before you start, then you debate it. And you're going to have, maybe then you could have a generation of kids who leave school after 6 years, maybe three debate classes a year, who know how to do this. Mm. We've got to kick in critical thinking and we have to stop falling out with silly things. So yeah. I want to, if I can attract people like that to this idea, then we can have a good head start. We can have a good head start. You can speak to people.
And those people are out there. I mean, they're there. It's just expecting anyone to step up and into public life to, that could be a challenge, but nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm very happy. Tracy, myself here, we love the cat. We have a good lifestyle, enjoy my work 4 days a week, it's great. I don't particularly want to change anything about my lifestyle, but I ran last year because I would love to got these ideas.
What was your takeaway from your election run?
Well, the takeaway was that I got 364 first preference votes. I needed 10 times that even to get in the race. Mm. It's very, very difficult. I did in a profile. I was lucky to have four canvassers out to me, four or five. I'm very thankful to those, you know, needed more, needed a machine, didn't have it, you know. It's very difficult. And then, of course, you have your limited budget when the parties have a big budget to spend.
But you're also trying to eke out, right? You're trying to eke out from a group of people that is not the entire electorate. It's very hard to get people to change which way they're going to vote. So really the people, the group, the number of people that you had to work with, especially with a relatively moderate sort of platform when you're up against people with, you know, very emotive views that might be easy for those that are disgruntled to vote for. Yeah. Like it's not a bad return for a first go at it, like.
Well, no, look, I'm very thankful to those who voted for me. I really am. And I appreciate every single person went out. I appreciate every single vote I got. But it's very, very difficult to look at Greg. I didn't ever run it. Some said, and quite rightly, they should have run for the council 6 months earlier. I didn't even think at that stage I was going to run for the Dáil, you know. Just no head start of any sort, behind the eight ball from the start. Mm. And very difficult. And as you're saying, people don't get this national as local, but you know, I was one man knocking on maybe, I got through maybe 80% Letterkenny and didn't get out of the town, couldn't get out of the town, didn't have enough time, I didn't have enough weather, didn't have enough people. So I was trying to get this, among other things, this national is local idea across, you know. But if you have a party, I think, you know, of people together who are gathering momentum, let's say I'm lucky enough to get a dozen people first meeting. Let's say it gathers a few more. There's a young girl down from Burton Port down in Athenry at the moment who thinks that's a great idea. She's going to her university down there. She's going to go to Dublin. She's going to try and spread this. She spoke to some students who think it's a great idea. You know, there's a wee start at this stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from small acorn seeds, et cetera.
But do you see yourself as, would you see yourself as a conservative or liberal?
I don't even like badges. Mm. I mean,
but it's inevitable. It's inevitable, Jerry. Like,
I know it is. But people will describe what they think I am. But
well, my point is, here's this, right? Okay. So, say for instance, you get the seven to people elected. You talk of the stuff you talked of: more investment in infrastructure. You know, national is local, or local is national. They're interchangeable, and all that type of stuff. But then people want to know your position on abortion. I'm not asking you about abortion now. I'm not getting into that, right? Or the trans issue, or whatever it might be, some of the most emotive issues that you'd be expected to have a stance on, or your party would be expected to have a stance on. Could you switch off your own moral sensibilities, whichever they may flow? Is that a price you'd be prepared to pay for a party that might shake things up in the other areas that you're interested in?
Well, I think that's where democracy comes into it. If you have a party and you've recruited who you think are reasonable, responsible, respectful people, then I would hope you get respectful, responsible policies on those issues coming from those people. You know, I'm very live and let live, very live and let live. As someone to come, so someone, go ahead, it's your business, you know. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. And I like to think and imagine that, again, being very idealistic, as usual, Greg, on this, you know, the people I would hope to draw to this will be reasonably similar, and that they're going to be reasonable people.
Yeah.
And I do also believe, you know, that on particular matters of conscience, there probably shouldn't be a whip in a party. You know, you may agree that or not, I don't know, but it's just my opinion that, you know.
I'm not really, I don't know, I'm kind of funny. I don't concern myself really with parties or politics. I'm really apolitical, to be honest with you. And
I'm the same as you.
Yeah, I don't know which way I would vote, and it certainly wouldn't swing on whether there was a whip there or not. So I don't know. Mm. I think that's more from within a party. I don't really care what they do. And I do care. That sounds a terrible throwaway thing. What do you see as the greatest threat to this nation at the moment? And I mean, like, not just in this moment, but next 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, well, you know, I do believe, I'm back to the old thing again, the infrastructure. We're 25% behind developed countries in Europe in infrastructure. And one of the most immediate dangers in that is that we may lose corporate Ireland. I think we raised 105 billion last year to run the country, and 39 billion that was from corporate, 25 billion that was from American corporates. If we can't give them, if we are going to have rolling blackouts, as some predict, by 2030, we can't give them electricity, water, sewage. We can't give them affordable homes. And if the country does degrade anymore and looks more slummy, then they may not choose to stay. If we lose 25 billion a year, the benefit system, the pension system, is going to fall apart. I think we have to move towards infrastructure work, massive infrastructure work. And I also believe that, again, I'm very idealistic, Greg. If this work gets done, let's say my scenario comes about, we get 70 people elected, and we're going to go down a different route, radical route, infrastructure, etc. I think before a brick's even turned, I think people will see there's hope here, we're doing things differently.
Yeah.
I think people come back to Australia. We have a massive diaspora. We have one guy come back to Mulford lately who's going to invest in the area, a wealthy man. And people could come back in droves if they think, God, this is the country to live in again. Because, you know, is Australia the country to live in? Can you afford a house in Australia?
Not all rosy in the garden there. No. The other thing, and I don't want to sound like I'm trying to pick holes in your ideological argument.
No, I love Devil's Jack. It was a great way. Yeah,
it's the system, right? The system people would feel is so broken. Civil service, and I'm not on about the wonderful staff that you might see at a canter letter, Kenny. I'm on about the suits, right? The HSE. and others, there's a lot of people believe that even if a good person got in there and says, I'm going to do this, that that permanent government can't be worked with. That you could never get the throughput through it to actually achieve the goals. That's how broken the system is. The elected government is tinkering around the edges, but it's the permanent government, that deeply enrooted civil service, that everything must pass through to get to the ground.
I do think that the way we're going is not going to work. But therefore, right, we can say, like, and you're not suggesting we don't try something. I'm suggesting, I know you're not doing that. But let's say the suggestion is, well, Jerry, it's not going to work. There's not a lot of point. I hear this from some people, you know. Then the alternative is to do nothing, to go where we're going. And going where we're going is not going to fix anything. And, you know, I remember talking to you last year, over a year ago now, about Jerry Robinson, and who went and did that fabulous BBC programme a long time ago, where he went into Rotherham Hospital through talking to unions, through talking to staff, through talking to administrators, common sense, decency, over a number of months, got the hospital running extremely well. And he went back a year later to see how it was going, still going the way he left it. And the NHS then took that programme and used it, scaled it out to their hospitals and fixed the NHS. And for years, the NHS was a fabulous health giver. Thanks to a man with Jerry Robinson's talents, his charisma, his intelligence, his decency, he went on and did this. And I'm looking for these people. And, you know, there's a way we try to fix the HSE, because people say it's not the money, you know, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but people say it isn't. But, you know, again,
the money's there, but you see, we know the money's there. It's frustrating because as we're recording this, a report just kind of slipped under the radar a little bit that ruled out a rail infrastructure from Donegal to Sligo because there's no demand. That's what they deemed. Yet at the same time, they're pumping hundreds of millions of euro into cycle paths and other measures. And I'm not opposed to that, don't get me wrong. But we have to believe that they'll be used. So, you know, a piece of infrastructure that a lot of people would want and would believe would be well used is not going ahead because they don't believe the demand would be there. And then we get all this other infrastructure that people don't necessarily want and don't believe will ever be used, but the state is pumping the millions, tens and tens and tens of millions into it. It's a peculiar situation, and I wouldn't like to go in and try and fix all that stuff. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, you know, again, we keep talking, people talk about, you know, the government do this, they're not going to do that. But I'm going back to square one again. I'm looking for these 70 elected to lead us. And I'm talking about what they would do. I'm talking about what the government do at the moment. I'm talking about what they would do if they get there. And again, a very idealistic, don't get me wrong, I know it is, but I think we have to aim for idealism.
So what's the first piece of, if you get these 70 elected, what's the first, the very first piece of legislation you believe must be passed to subvert the subversion?
Let me see. That's a good question now, because there's so many things. I think we want to work on getting urban councils back to give us a voice back. I mean, if we had a voice back, one of the first things we'd say is this active travel thing is not going to work for us. You know, so you're talking about that problem you just talked about. That could be addressed.
It doesn't do anything for me because we never had an urban council in Donegal Town. So I'm out instantly with this plan of yours. It's all Letterkenny.
Right. Well, you see, but again, maybe the urban council situation could be that urban councils are made up of voluntary people. I could volunteer to an urban council who would then go to Lifford with suggestions that should be, and every town in the county that wants to have an urban council could have one. Yeah. You know, you could start like that. You know, they've got to listen to the room. We don't particularly want active travel. 90% of people don't want this active travel scheme. It's not, I think, was Donegal granted another 10 million again for this year?
Yeah, but that includes greenways. So
there's a lot of good.
But
stuff
we don't have a plan for keeping greenways. We build them, but there's no maintenance of them, which is causing anger. In terms of what's next for you, you're loving the barbering. You're going to keep at that. You like to keep the two plates spinning, do you? You know, you're a bit of advocacy writing, obviously, which is significant. You know, to put something to paper and to put it out there, you know, not a lot of us do that. But where's your future, do you see, in terms of, you know, I don't know, politics, your work, your own life? At some point, maybe you want to put your feet up.
I have no idea, really. It sounds strange to say it. It sounds like I'm rudderless. But I assume that I'm going to try and beat this horse as much as it needs beaten. I don't think I'm flogging a dead horse yet, anyway. I intend to push as hard as I can because, you know, the book took about 6 months to read. I want to thank Desi Galler because Desi Galler gave me a tip of, you're writing the book, get your feet under the table. So I sat at the table, wrote the book. But that's easy. But the hard bit now is getting people to buy an idea, especially an idea that's so radical. And especially to a people who I think are programmed and conditioned to complain all day. I think we have the same conversation every day. The subject matter is different.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? I don't see myself running again. But look, I mean, look, who knows where this could go? Who knows what?
It's interesting. I think you said really early on, and I think it's actually the same for religion, to get people back into churches or mosques or wherever they're going, is things have to get an awful lot worse. It's almost like this is a cyclical thing where things get right on the brink. And maybe we're heading that way with the geopolitical situation, but you get right into the brink whereby your very existence is at threat. And that's where the reset comes from, be it in terms of faith or be it in terms of political change. You know, we have this cycle over thousands of years of peace and war and peace and war. Yeah, and yet here we are sitting in 2026 believing that we're going to be at peace forever, that man won't do what it always does. So hopefully it's not for ages, but maybe that will be the true catalyst of change in many areas of life.
You've just given me chapter one in the book, basically. You know, you've just given me chapter one. Empires that thought they would never crumble.
Yeah.
Are we living now in the sort of Western world capitalistic empire that we think will never crumble? Of course it's going to crumble. Will it crumble now? Perhaps. But I think, you know, if we're going to rescue it, we have to do something radical, something different. You know, you use the word reset, reboot. That's exactly what we need. Mm. And if we're going to have it, it has to start with an idea. The seed has to start somewhere. And I don't see any other game-changing ideas out there. I don't see any of them. There's no ideas out there, which is probably a good thing, Greg, because, you know, if there are three or four ideas with three or four potential parties, that could split a vote. If we get everyone behind one idea, there's a code I use regularly in the book. Is for the one hacking at the root, there's 1,000 hacking at the branches. We have lots of activists out there hacking at their branch of activism. If we could all get together, perhaps their branch of activism could be fixed. If we could all form a government who wants to fix all those branches. Mm. I think we all need to get together, be active on the one front, and you never know what we could achieve, you know.
Finally, you know, notwithstanding everything we've talked about and the work that has to be done improving infrastructure, improving our health system, ensuring that we have a country that respects old people and cares for them and us as we become them going forward. It's very sad, isn't it, that so many young people have to leave what is, I think, the best place in the world. I think the northwest of Ireland, I think Donegal is. It's the very best of us. We talk about stuff that's wrong. What part of Donegal do you love? What is it about the county that you love the most? Is it always Letterkenny? Do you like to get out of town? Or maybe you're going to say Derry now just to make sure you're welcome back there at some point.
Well, there's so many walks around Donegal. Donegal is just, it is paradise. We're so lucky to have Donegal. We love the Antrim Coast. I feel my spiritual home is the Causeway. I just love the Causeway. Visit there every time I go up that way. Born in Derry, like Derry, played snooker in Derry. Love the Muckers, love the attitude. We're just so lucky to live in this wing of the world, you know, it's fabulous. But I think we could really make it a paradise again. And it's going to take effort. It's going to take bravery. It's going to take ambition. And, you know, my idea is incredibly ambitious. I know that. But I don't see another game-changing idea out there. And so I think it'll turn, unless we try something, the only option is we keep on the road we're on. And I think that's the road to hell, really.
All right, Jerry McKeever, thanks so much for being a guest on Go Ahead. I was going to ask you where you can get the book. I've been doing this too long.
Being the poet you are. It's called Saving Democracy, a proactive plan. And
so it's available on Amazon, isn't it? But also, yes. Where can people get a? When you order something on Amazon, is that a physical book that gets sent out to you, or is that a?
Yeah, the book it is. Yeah, or the ebook. They send either. Yeah, Bookmark and Letterkenny, very good to me. Aisling and David, very good to me. David's going to have a book signing session Saturday week. Me down at the down there. They've been very, very good to me. I'm selling the barbershop as well. So those are your three ports of call. I want to get it out to other bookshops if I can, but I need a bit more urgency. I need to get on the phone a bit more. I'm not great at asking people to do things for me. I'm not a great. I don't think it's pride ring. I just feel awkward asking people to do things. And
do you think that's because you've worked independently your whole life, really effectively, haven't you?
I suppose I'm asking people to come to me, right? But I have to get more proactive, really, myself for this, you know, right. Pushing more. But if there's anyone out there, look, who likes the idea, likes maybe wants to read the book, who wants to talk to me, please come talk to me in the barbershop. I love devil's advocacy. I love debate on it. And I certainly like to hear people who might agree with me and could help me take this a step or two further, you know. Greg, thanks very much.
Give us the title of the book once more.
It's called Saving Democracy. A proactive plan, and I think it does what it says in the tin. I think it is very, very much a proactive plan.
All right, Jerry McKeever, thanks so much for joining us. So that's where we leave it for episode 2 of the Greg Hughes podcast. A big thanks to Caroline Orr, who researches and produces this program from Highland Radio. If you have any suggestions or comments or feedback on the podcast, please email us, caroline.orr@highlandradio.com. But check out the Highland Radio website. We'll be back with another episode real soon.